celebration, right? It's okay to show a little bit of excitement. It's okay to show a little bit of emotion, because today is a celebration of ideas. Hi, I'm Greg Wirth, and I'm one of the organizers of today's TEDx event. And I'm so happy that all of you are here to be a part of this here at Murray State University. TED stands for technology, it stands for entertainment and design, and it started in 1984 as a conference to bring people together, to share ideas. Ideas to make people think, ideas to make people talk, and ideas to get people to act. And it's really a celebration of collaboration. And so with that in mind, we had the opportunity when we found out there was a TEDx event, or an independently organized event, to bring to Murray State. We got excited, and we're glad that so many other people got excited about it as well. And with that said, we today have put together three fantastic speakers and asked three fantastic speakers to come in and talk today, as well as two TED Talks that we'll showcase on a video. And we hope that today that you hear something that makes you think, and that you hear something that makes you talk, and that you hear something that makes you act. It's a celebration of collaboration. So turn off your cell phones and turn on your minds, and welcome to TEDx Murray State U.
Our first guest speaker tonight has a host of achievements and a hugely successful career. As a Murray State alumni with a degree in marketing, Mr. Van Hoosier went on to receive his MBA from Nova Southeastern University in Fort Lauderdale, Florida in 1989. After completing his MBA, he began working as an entrepreneur and expert in leadership, management, and training. As president of Van Hoosier Associates, he has developed and marketed keynotes on leadership, authored 4 books on business, and as well as produced countless leadership training videos. Mr. Van Hoosier is also the founder and concept director of Leaders Ought to Know, a comprehensive leadership development program. Mr. Van Hoosier has also worked as a Fortune 500 human resource manager, served as president of the National Speakers Association, and served on the Murray State University Alumni Board of Governors. He currently serves as director of the Board of Farmers Bank and Trust Company. Among his many achievements, Mr. Van Hoosier earned the highest honor designated by the National Speakers Association in 1993. In 2011, he was awarded the Top 5 Speaker by Speaker Platform, and in 2006, he was awarded the Council of Peers Award of Excellence and inducted into the Speaker Hall of Fame. The booming growth of Mr. Van Hoosier's company has provided him with numerous opportunities to work with many levels of management, where he has gathered keen insights into effective leadership practices. His expertise in the field has been acknowledged globally, and more than 900 companies have trusted Mr. Van Hoosier to inspire success in their organization. Today, we are thrilled and honored that he has agreed to join us. Please help me welcome Mr. Philip Van Hoosier.
You did good. Thank you. Thank you very much. It's a wonderful honor to be here, and I'm here to share an idea. Now, to begin with, I need to assume that all of you want to be successful. Is that true?
Yes.
Now, to be successful, a lot of people today will define success in many different ways. They'll define it relative to riches, they'll define it relative to opportunity, they'll define it relative to power or position, and I'm not going to argue any of those points. However, I am going to share with you my definition of success and then how to exercise success in your own experience. My definition of success is very, very simple. Success equals choices. The more choices we have, the more successful we are, I believe, and therefore, the more choices we have, the more opportunities that can come from them. Now, I don't expect you to totally agree with this or disagree with this at this moment, but think through it for a second. If we have choices to make, as opposed to someone else making our choices for us, it only goes to reason that we're going to have more opportunities that come from it. For example, the more choices we have, the more successful we are. The more limited the choices, the more limited our opportunities. And the worst case scenario, of course, of all, is if someone else is making all of our choices for us. Now, I'm going to try to share with you an idea, a technique, even a process that maybe will help you in the choices that you make going forward and the decisions that you'll make, because I know it helped me. Now, you already heard in the introduction that I I'm a graduate of this university, and I am thrilled to be a Murray State grad. However, the process that I'm about to share with you, I did not learn on campus. I learned in the 6 weeks after I graduated from Murray State University. Because in those 6 weeks, after leaving Murray State University, I attended a professional baseball umpiring school. And it was there that I learned a process of making decisions under pressure and in sometimes the most heated of experiences or environments that I'm now going to share with you. I like to call them the five bases for decision-making success. And I'll start with you by sharing the first two of the bases. Now, the first two of the bases, I'm hoping, are going to be covered in your educational pursuits. For example, the first base for any decision that you'll make going forward is you got to have the tools. You got to have the tools. You come to the university, you come to this college, and into whatever respective college you may be in, trying to learn the tools necessary to be successful in the profession that you have chosen. Now think about this for a second. Every profession has its unique set of tools that are necessary to be successful. A carpenter has a hammer, has a level, has a tape measure. But a doctor has a scalpel, a blood pressure cuff, a syringe. Now, of course, I'm oversimplifying here, but understand that any profession you choose is going to require you to have tools and be able to know how to use those tools. The tools that I'm talking about decision making are research, being able to ask the right questions, being able to explore the opportunities, understanding that we don't want to discount anything out of hand, but that everything should be considered a possibility until we decide further. So number one, I want you to understand that to make good decisions, you got to have the tools. Number two, to make good decisions, you got to know the rules. Now, I mentioned a moment ago that I went to an umpire school. Well, umpires have tools. You know, the chest protectors, the mask, the shin guards. Those are the obvious ones. And they also must know the rules. We know that every contest, every sporting contest has a rule book. How many of you, by the way, have ever played a sporting played in a sporting event or played a sport where the official, the referee, the umpire, whatever, did not know the rules? Let me see a show of hands. What can you expect from that point forward? Chaos, confusion, frustration, anger, certainly disappointment in that we don't get the best out of the two teams because nobody knows the rules. I'm going to suggest to you that this is one of the harder of things for young professionals to learn because they think everything should be written. But in fact, there are two kinds of tools that we need to be aware of. There are the written rules. Those are laws, regulations, policies, procedures, etc. Those are fairly easy. All you have to do is read those, memorize those, learn those, reference those. But some of the more challenging of the rules are the unwritten rules. The unwritten rules are driven by culture, habit, are determined by circumstance, history, the way it's always been done in the past, and therefore we either assume that it should always be done in the present if, of course, we helped create that rule, or if we had no way of creating that rule, then we question every rule as to whether or not it's valid or not. Now, I hurry through those first two because I trust that the professors, the deans, the administrators, the people that you come in contact every day here with, who are trying to prepare you for that next venture, are giving you the tools necessary and are sharing with you the rules, both the written rules and preparing you for the habits and procedures that will determine the unwritten rules. But it's the final three steps that I learned at that umpiring school that have helped me the most in making the most successful and effective decisions. Step number three is this: position yourself effectively. Now think about that for a second. We can have the tools and we can know the rules, but if we find ourselves out of position, the opportunities oftentimes go unnoticed. And even if we notice the opportunity, we're not in a position to take advantage of them because we have not prepared ourselves accordingly. We must position ourselves effectively. Now, You don't have to be a baseball fan to understand this, but occasionally umpires get caught out of position. And they get caught out of position for three basic reasons. And if you understand these three basic reasons well enough, you'll understand that anybody, whether you ever step on a baseball field or not, can also suffer from the three. Okay? Here we go. Three reasons why an umpire might be caught out of position. Number one, they were unprepared. They were unprepared for what was expected of them. They were unprepared for what was going to come next. Some of you are wondering, well, what does come next? There's always going to be a question mark. We can never predict with certainty what the future will hold. However, what we can say is that we can prepare ourselves for the moment, and then when the position or when the circumstance or situation unfolds in the future, we're better prepared to deal accordingly. All right, preparation. The second thing is lack of preparation and lack of hustle. Lack of hustle. Unfortunately, sometimes umpires, and this is the term that is used in a baseball game, sometimes an umpire takes a play off. Now, what does that mean? To take a play off, that means I'm going to relax for a bit. That means I'm going to try to catch my breath. Nothing much is happening around me, so I'm not going to be diligent. I'm not going to be focused. And it's almost always at that moment that the unthinkable happens. The unexpected happens. When you let down your guard, as if I'll come to work today and I won't give it my best, that's the day that someone watches you perform and decides you're not what it takes to be successful moving forward in the future. We've got to prepare ourselves. We've got to hustle. But then the third thing that comes into play is this. On a baseball field, occasionally things get, what I like to say, squirrely. Now what does that mean? A bad hop. The ball goes someplace that nobody expects. There's no way we could have anticipated a particular activity. And so therefore the umpires go, "Oh, I didn't see that coming," and so therefore it becomes difficult to be in position. However, if they have prepared well in advance, and if they're hustling, even when things get squirrely, when the unexpected happens, they can respond pretty quickly. However, if they haven't hustled and if they haven't prepared themselves, when things get squirrely, problems, well, they mount, they magnify, they become bigger all the time. Now, one of the things that I learned was having the tools and knowing the rules will not put me in the position that I need to be successful. I have to intentionally choose the position that I want to ultimately be in. Which leads me to the fourth consideration in these five bases for success. We've got to have the tools, we've got to know the rules, we've got to position ourselves effectively, and number four, we must master our timing. Master our timing. When we start talking about decision making, there's basically two ways you can make a mistake as it relates to timing. You can either decide too quickly, or you can take too long to decide. Deciding too quickly means you jump to conclusions. Deciding too quickly means that you let emotion rule your decision. You become emotionally charged and therefore you respond too quickly. But on the other hand, if you wait too long, people start to challenge whether or not you're decisive enough or focused enough or capable enough to be successful in your decision making. I always tell people who I am working with from a managerial perspective, I say, we need to be quick, but don't hurry. Be quick. Understand that there is a time element to everything. Be quick, but don't hurry so fast that you miss or lose the opportunity that's available to you. The final one, the fifth point is you got to make the call. You got to drive your stake in the ground. You got to say, all right, I have the tools. I know the rules. I've positioned myself effectively. I've mastered the timing. But if you don't choose to decide, frankly, we haven't made a successful decision. There are four types of decisions that you should already be prepared to make. First of all, never make a decision that is illegal, immoral, unethical, or highly impractical. Nothing good can come from that. If it's illegal, immoral, highly impractical, or unprofessional, then the fact of the matter is we're going to struggle individually. But on the other hand, if we already know what is acceptable to us, we go forward from there. A few years ago, I had the opportunity of speaking at Fort Bragg Military Installation in Fayetteville, North Carolina. There I met a gentleman who was a commander of a special forces, United States military. He and I had an opportunity to have a dinner together. And during the dinner, I asked him a very simple question. I said to him, how do you train soldiers to be the elite of the elite fighting force in the world? He said, and I quote, it's a decision they make. And he proceeded to tell me it's about tools and rules and positioning and mastering timing. He told me all the things that I'd learned on a baseball diamond, but then he added one more thing. He said, when our soldiers get together to train, he said, every morning we chant together. Now, having not been in the military, that caught me by surprise. I said, what do you mean you chant together? Oh, we run, we work out, do our physical training, but we chant together. We share a common bond. I said, well, share one with me. He said, oh, there's so many. And I said, well, pick one. This is the one he shared with me, and I'll never know why, but I'll forever be grateful that he did. He looked at me and he said, and I quote, on my honor, I commit that I will never leave a fallen comrade to be taken captive by the enemy. On my honor, I commit that I will never leave a fallen comrade to be taken captive by the enemy. I said, what does that mean? He said, it means exactly what they said. They have made the decision based on the rules and the tools and the positioning and the timing. They've made the decision that they will stand by one another regardless what happens. I left that meeting with that gentleman that night. I flew home the next day, but it was hard for me to get the entire experience out of my mind. I kept thinking about what he said. On my honor, I commit that I will never leave a fallen comrade to be taken captive by the enemy. I got to wondering, what if every company started their day by having everybody come in the room and chant together? What if every family started the day around the dinner table or breakfast table holding hands and chanting together? Oh, the chant might be slightly different. On our honor, you can believe that I'm with you, that I'll back you up, that I'll support you, that I'll love you, and that together we'll get through anything. That's a decision that lays a foundation for thousands of other decisions that can help us be successful. It's a decision that made earlier in the life allows us the opportunity to be more successful, as opposed to if made later in life, unfortunately dooms us to more difficulty. As we finish these kinds of sessions where we come to share ideas together, the first and most important idea is we've got to decide that we're going to support, love, encourage, and always be supportive of one another. Thank you very much for your time. I enjoyed being here very much. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Thank you. Thank you.
Our next speaker is also one of our very own alumni. Kayla Barrett holds both a bachelor's and master's degree in organizational communication from Murray State. As president of Organization Impact, Kayla has over 18 years of experience in both the corporate and nonprofit sector. In her career, Kayla has focused her expertise on human resources and training and development. This is evident in her success as director, holding 3 distinguished positions throughout the years, including Director of Human Resources, Staff Development, and Organizational Strategy. One of her greatest accomplishments is her 10-year contribution to the Gaylord Entertainment Company, where she acted as coordinator and assisted in the launch of the Gaylord Texas Resort and Convention Center. Kayla participated in a number of organizations, from the Society of Human Resources Management to the Association of Professional Women. She is also involved with the Middle Tennessee Chamber of Commerce and is a member of the Executive Advisory Board of the Murray State University LinkedIn Association. Today, she joins us to discuss how to stand out in a crowded marketplace. Please help me welcome the lovely Miss Kayla Barrett.
Good Hi, everyone. It is a pleasure to be with you. And as we begin this afternoon, I would like to start with a photo of my nephew. You need to meet this guy. So I'm going to transition if we can turn our slides on. I'd like you to meet him. And here he is. He's Joey. He's 8 years old. And in this picture, I think he is the perfect visual for what we're going to talk about today, how to stand out in the marketplace. Now, he has four sisters, and if you can notice where he is in the photo, he is clearly standing out, and he always does if you ever get the opportunity to meet him. But it's a great visual, what we're going to talk about today. Standing out in the marketplace is something every business and every professional, every student tries to do at some point. And unfortunately, and I think all too often, we've seen some really great examples of this, and we've seen some very poor ones. And in an age of 24/7 technology, 24/7 instant publicity, I think it's a topic that's very important for us to slow down a bit today and focus on and really look at a clear roadmap of how to do this well. And that's what we're going to talk about. Now, the topic has lots of implications. I'm thrilled to see so many faces here today, which means we have lots of different walks of life here. Some of you are students, and you are about to earn that degree and put yourself out there in the job market, and you want to stand out against every other applicant that you're trying to get that job with. You want that hiring manager to choose you over everyone else. Some of us in the room are already in the workplace, and we are established professionals, and you want that executive to pick you for that promotion. You're ready. Choose me over everybody else who might also be qualified. Some of us are business owners in the room. And you have a product, you have a service, and you want customers to clearly choose you over the competitor who might actually offer the same service and product you do. So pick me. I want to stand out in the marketplace. We're in an age of social cause, and there are so many things that are wonderful to be a part of. And you may be involved in an organization like that, and you want other folks to come alongside you and contribute to that cause as well. So you have to stand out. You have to be different. Today we're going to look at two different questions, and you'll see them on our screen. Number one, do I stand out? But secondly, is that how I want to stand out? And the distinction is incredibly critical. So this is what we'll do. I'm going to use graphics. I'm a visual learner. And this is the graphic we're going to walk through today. You and I are that little funny stick figure in the middle of the graphic. And on one side, you're going to see how character and competence, as they manifest through our behavior, as they play out in what we do, our behavior, our actions, how those drive or influence the decisions of those that we want to be noticeable to. So we talked about college students. You want to stand out to that hiring manager. That's going to be seen through how you manifest your character and your competence before them. If you're a current professional today, your character and your competence and how you manifest those, how you act those out, are going to make the difference on whether you're chosen. For business leaders in the day, it's how a customer chooses you and how your business plays out in its character and its competence. Now, here's what's interesting. These two topics are completely interwoven. You can't take one without taking the other. So let's play that out for just a little bit. Have you ever known anyone who's incredibly talented? They're smart. Oh, they know their stuff. But you can't trust them. You know anybody like that? No one in this room, right? But we may know someone like that. But you have to flip it. Have you ever known someone who would do absolutely anything for you, but everything they tell you, you have to fact check? You're not quite sure it's accurate? Well, that's how it works. Those two are so integrated and related that I can't take one without taking the other. So in this roadmap we're going to talk about today, we're going to, number one, define these terms, because I want to make sure we're on the same page with that and clearly understand what do we mean by competence, but what do we need by my personal character as well. And then I'm going to give you three very easy, very tactical ways to make sure these stay on your radar, because my goal for everybody in this room is I want you to stand out, but I want you to stand out for the right reasons. I never want to see your picture on a YouTube video. I never want to see someone rant about, oh, don't ever do business with so-and-so because fill in the blank. And in our age today, it's very, very possible. So here's what we'll do. We're going to define what I mean by character and what I mean by competence. We'll start with competence. For our context today, that simply means your skills, your abilities, your talents, those things that help you do what you do well. But here's the key. I can't just have skills. To stand out, I have to do those with excellence. I have to do them better than everybody else. So let's give a couple of examples. Let's say you're an accountant. You want to be an accountant. Well, that means you have to understand debits and credits. You have to understand financial terminology. You have to understand what does it mean to balance a set of books at the end of a business month so we make money. I have to know all of those things. But if I'm really excelling in my competence, that means I do that better than anybody else. I have a depth of knowledge at that. Let's say you're a supervisor. You work with a group of folks. Your competence might mean, I've got to understand our business, I've got to understand our customers, I've got to understand what our products do and don't do, I've got to understand all of our budgeting, all of our processes, but because I oversee people, my competence also means that I have to know how to lead and guide and motivate them. And I have to do that very well, with excellence. So that's what we're talking about with our competence. Now, flip to the other side, character. That's a really pretty word, but it involves things like integrity, intention, follow-through, initiative, trustworthiness. Character is who you are and who you say you are with or without an audience. A colleague once told me, he said, Kayla, I define character this way. It's who you are when nobody's looking. And that's pretty cutting. Isn't it? We can say a lot of things about ourselves, but do the actions really follow it through? Now, with competence, to really stand out, you begin to achieve a level of excellence with those skills. With character, it's defined through time and consistency. So, for example, we talked about that accountant. I've got to know my debits and credits. I've got to know how all of that works. Well, with character, it would sound something like this. Can my friends or my colleagues or my family trust me all the time? When I say I'm going to do something, do I consistently follow through with that so they don't worry when they ask me to help them with something? This one's a lot harder to put into practice, which is why we're going to spend a little bit more time on it, to be honest with you, because I think it's one of our greatest challenges today, regardless of your station in life. Now, I said these two work hand in hand. Which means I can do all I want to improve my competency and be the smartest person I can be in whatever field of study that might be. But if I neglect really focusing on who I am as a person, who I say I am, I may achieve some success, but it'll be very short term. And it works the same way the other way. I want to keep working and focus on being the very best person I can be, but if I'm not continually trying to improve my skill set, and I had a professor once tell me that's adding tools in your toolkit. If you don't keep doing that, then I can have the best of intentions, but I don't have the skill to follow it through. So it takes both of those. So what I'm going to share with you this afternoon are three very quick action steps that are practical, that anyone in the room could do. So this isn't way up here in theory. This isn't only if you make X amount of money, and this isn't only if you've been in the business world for 10 years. They apply to all of us, regardless of who we are. And this is how it works. I'm going to start on competence, and I want to give you three success strategies. Number one is I get better and we get better. Let me define what that means. For someone who's really focusing on their competence, I want to be the best fill in the blank I can be. Then that means on a regular basis, I am focusing on improving my skills. And those skills could be lots of things. But someone who is truly focused on standing out in the right way, they have some type of goal all the time. The most successful business leaders that I work with have new goals every 30 days. Every month they're working on something. And one month might be, this is my leadership month, Kayla, and I'm really working on how I talk with the people that I lead every day. I really want to do that well, and I want to understand the best way to manage Sally versus the best way to manage Bob. It's very, very different, perhaps. And that's their goal. Another month, it's I want to learn as much as I can about the customers that I serve. I want to learn as much about Murray State, and because I want to give back to this organization. So what can I learn about its history? That might be a goal. But every month, there's something intentional about getting better. As we grow up and as we move on into the workplace, you're going to find a couple of things. One, the older we get and the longer we do what we do, there is a desire to go deeper and deeper and deeper in our job knowledge, or deeper and deeper and deeper in our understanding. And that's what makes you an expert. But don't forget the opportunity to go this way, too. This gives me depth in what I know. Breadth gives me understanding of how it all fits together. And one education goal might be not about what I do every day, but I want to understand what you do. And that might be a goal. Because what happens, people notice that. If you're learning, it doesn't stay right here. You have to tell somebody about it. You have to share with them. And so for someone who stands out, they begin to see a change in behavior. That person's always doing something different. That person's always learning. That person's always sharing some new insight with me. And it makes you different. Now, if you are in a role in life where you impact others, say you're in a leadership role today, that's the we part of this. If I'm getting better, the natural outflow of that is I'm going to help those around me get better too. You can't help it. So you're helping them move to the next level. And so that's part one. In anybody in this room, we can have a 30-day education goal on something. And it's more than what your books tell you to do. It's more than the class assignments that you might have. But it's how am I growing as a person. Number two, you can see on our list, is I call it a lessons learned model. Mistakes are inevitable. They will happen. The key on this one is, do I keep making the same ones over and over and over again? I had a guy tell me once this story. He said, I tell my team, I want you to mess up. He said, I want you to think of that as having a loaded gun. And you're going to miss sometimes. Your aim's going to be off and you might shoot yourself in the foot. That's okay. Do it once. Fix your aim. Don't keep shooting the same foot. Figure it out. And what we're talking about here is this wisdom over time that people begin to see, wow, that person grows. They've matured. And look at where they used to be. Look where they are now. And they have a discipline of slowing down every now and then and hitting that pause button. It's what I call it, the pause button in life. When we mess up or when something completely blows up, instead of doing this and who messed up, we have that moment of stepping back to say, what could I do so that that doesn't happen again in the future? Is there something proactive that I could look at? If I would have approached this or looked at this a little bit differently, could we have had a different outcome? And if you're in a role of leadership, it's an incredible discipline to create with your team so that as a team, we don't keep making the same mistakes over and over and over again. I do consulting. I do teaching. I do organization development work. Because so many people don't know how to do that, I have job security. Because a lot of people haven't figured that piece out. And so much of it is just not making those same mistakes over and again. The third one, and it's a natural outflow of this, is that we get results. If I'm continually learning, and the people around me are as well, and we're learning from these mistakes, we are achieving results. Those never happen by accident. And so I would encourage the discipline here is that I have goals that I'm continually working toward. There may be several of them. But my discipline is I have lots of little milestones along the way to make sure I get there. And it's not just getting things done. We can all get stuff done. We can all check it off. But we get things done the right way. People look to us and say, you know, if I ask Bob to do something, I never have to worry about it. I know he's going to get it done, and I know he's going to do it the right way. Meaning no shortcuts, efficiency, but no shortcuts to quality. And also, you achieve results, but not at the expense of someone else. It's really where that we thing comes into play instead of my stuff. So those are the three. You really want to focus on your competency? Have some type of goal every 30 days to keep getting better at whatever your craft is, whatever your skill is, whatever your passion is. Intentionally continue to develop that. Make it deep, but have a broad approach as well. Secondly, develop the discipline of slowing down when things don't go right or things mess up and having that assessment moment to say, what could I do differently in the future, and then do something with it. And then thirdly, focus on getting the results that you are committing yourself to. Have a system in place that gives you many milestones to reach that point. And I'll be honest, this is the easy one, because that sounds pretty. I want to get smarter, I want to get better, I want to be more educated, I want to get sharper in my skill. Let's talk about the other side. How do I focus on my character? Well, these are my three steps. The first I call a mirror moment. It's always going to begin with the self-assessment. I have yet to met anyone, in my several years, I have never met anyone that would say, you know, I really want to be the worst person I could be. I mean, that might be your world, but I've never met anybody like that. Everybody wants to be better, and they say they're better, and they have great intentions. But I can't get there unless I slow down a bit and say, how am I really doing? So this is the mirror moment. It's self-assessment. I would encourage you periodically, slow your world down a little bit and think about the relationships in your life. How many people come to me for advice because they value my opinion or my insight? How often do people around me come to me and say, Kayla, I want you to take this project and run with it. I trust you. You go and do it. Or are people spoon-feeding me things they need me to do for them? Do people trust my outcomes? Do they trust my process? How many times do folks come to me and they say, I need to confide in you and I don't know what to do. Please help me. Because that trust is there that you're sound, you're solid, you're wise. Now, if you're not sure how to do that, how to ask those questions, because most of us we're pretty light on ourselves when it comes to that, ask someone around you, and I promise you they'll tell you. That's your starting point. Then number two and three are pretty closely related. You've got to have checks and balances in place. Those are tools and resources that every week, every 2 weeks, you pause and you say, what did I accomplish? Did I get done what I needed to get done? And if I didn't, how am I going to recorrect and autocorrect for the following week to stay on task? Who did I not follow through with? Who did I let down? Who did I make a promise to that I didn't circle back and correct? And those are tools and resources. It might be nothing more than a checklist. For some of us, that's all it needs. You don't need an iPhone to do that. You don't need technology. It's a piece of paper and a pencil just to walk me through that. And because we can't do things alone, that's why we put number three on the list. You need an accountability buddy. Nobody can do anything alone. We need folks in our life that come alongside us and keep us honest and keep us on target. And here's the key. Don't pick just anybody for that. Be extremely selective. These aren't your best friends. These aren't the people that are going to enable you and kind of add you on. They're the people that are going to say, Kayla, you messed up, and you need to fix that. You said you were going to do it, and you didn't. What are you going to do about it? That's all in love. But you need those people that are going to really be honest with you. I call it your personal board of directors. That's what you need. My goal for you, I want you to stand out in the marketplace. And if you do these things intentionally, I promise you, you will be different. People will make different decisions based on you, and you will stand out in the marketplace. Thank you.
Our first video tonight broaches the topic of body language and its importance on how we portray ourselves to others. The presenter in this video, Amy Cuddy, is a well-respected social psychologist. Cuddy currently serves as an associate professor of business administration in negotiation, organizations, and market units at the Harvard School of Business. After suffering a serious head injury in a car accident, Cuddy was scrutinized for years by her doctors on if she would ever regain her full mental capacity. Over the years, Cuddy has done that and much more in her study of nonverbal communication and how the relationship with judgments affect others' perceptions. Her research has revealed that body language does affect and alter our chemistry and how we perceive ourselves. The presentation you're about to see discusses how power posing can be an influence in these perceptions, not only by the position of our bodies. Also, her lecture discusses that if we convey positive postures, such as confidence, this could be a key to our success.
So I want to start by offering you a free, no-tech life hack. And all it requires of you is this, that you change your posture for 2 minutes. But before I give it away, I want to ask you to right now do a little audit of your body and what you're doing with your body. So how many of you are sort of making yourselves smaller? Maybe you're hunching, crossing your legs, maybe wrapping your ankles. Sometimes we hold on to our arms like this. Sometimes we spread out. I see you. So I want you to pay attention to what you're doing right now. We're going to come back to that in a few minutes. And I'm hoping that if you sort of learn to tweak this a little bit, it could significantly change the way your life unfolds. So we're really fascinated with body language. And we're particularly interested in other people's body language. You know, we're interested in, like, you know, an awkward interaction, or a smile, or a contemptuous glance, or maybe a very awkward wink, or maybe even something like a handshake.
Here they are arriving at number 10, and look at this lucky policeman gets to shake hands with the President of the United States. Oh, and here comes the Prime Minister of the... No.
A handshake or the lack of a handshake can have us talking for weeks and weeks and weeks, even the BBC and the New York Times. So obviously, when we think about nonverbal behavior or body language, but we call it nonverbals as social scientists, it's language. So we think about communication. When we think about communication, we think about interactions. So what is your body language communicating to me? What's mine communicating to you? And there's a lot of reason to believe that this is a valid way to look at this. So social scientists have spent a lot of time looking at the effects of our body language or other people's body language on judgments. And we make sweeping judgments and inferences from body language. And those judgments can predict really meaningful life outcomes, like who we hire or promote, who we ask out on a date. For example, Nalini Ambadi, a researcher at Tufts University, shows that when people watch 30-second soundless clips of real physician-patient interactions, their judgments of the physician's niceness predict whether or not that physician will be sued. So it doesn't have to do so much with whether or not that physician was incompetent, but do we like that person and how they interacted? Even more dramatic, Alex Todorov at Princeton has shown us that judgments of political candidates' faces in just 1 second predict 70% of US Senate and gubernatorial race outcomes. And even, let's go digital, emoticons used well in online negotiations can lead you to claim more value from that negotiation. If you use them poorly, bad idea, right? So when we think of nonverbals, we think of how we judge others, how they judge us, and what the outcomes are. We tend to forget, though, the other audience that's influenced by our nonverbals, and that's ourselves. We are also influenced by our nonverbals, our thoughts and our feelings and our physiology. So what nonverbals am I talking about? I'm a social psychologist. I study prejudice, and I teach at a competitive business school. So it was inevitable that I would become interested in power dynamics. I became especially interested in nonverbal expressions of power and dominance. And what are nonverbal expressions of power and dominance? Well, this is what they are. So in the animal kingdom, they are about expanding. So you make yourself big, you stretch out, you take up space, you're basically opening up. It's about opening up. And this is true across the animal kingdom. It's not just limited to primates, and humans do the same thing. So they do this both when they have power sort of chronically, and also when they're feeling powerful in the moment. And this one is especially interesting because it really shows us how universal and old these expressions of power are. This expression, which is known as pride, Jessica Tracy has studied, she shows that people who are born with sight and people who are congenitally blind do this when they win at a physical competition. So when they cross the finish line and they've won, it doesn't matter if they've never seen anyone do it, they do this. So the arms up in the V, the chin is slightly lifted. What do we do when we feel powerless? We do exactly the opposite. We close up, we wrap ourselves up, we make ourselves small. We don't want to bump into the person next to us. So again, both animals and humans do the same thing. And this is what happens when you put together high and low power. So what we tend to do when it comes to power is that we complement the other's nonverbals. So if someone's being really powerful with us, we tend to make ourselves smaller. We don't mirror them, we do the opposite of them. So I'm watching this behavior in the classroom, and what do I notice? I notice that MBA students really exhibit the full range of power nonverbals. So you have people who are like caricatures of alphas, like really come into the room, they get right into the middle of the room before class even starts, like they really want to occupy space. When they sit down, they're sort of spread out, they raise their hands like this. You have other people who are virtually collapsing when they come in. As soon as they come in, you see it. You see it on their faces and their bodies, and they sit in their chair and they make themselves tiny, and they go like this when they raise their hand. I noticed a couple things about this. One, you're not going to be surprised, it seems to be related to gender. So women are much more likely to do this kind of thing than men. Women feel chronically less powerful than men, so this is not surprising. But the other thing I noticed is that it also seemed to be related to the extent to which the students were participating and how well they were participating. And this is really important in the MBA classroom because participation counts for half the grade. So business schools have been struggling with this gender grade gap. You get these equally qualified women and men coming in, and then you get these differences in grades, and it seems to be partly attributable to participation. So I started to wonder, you know, okay, so you have these people coming in like this and they're participating. Is it possible that we could get people to fake it, and would it lead them to participate more? So my main collaborator, Dana Carney, who's at Berkeley, and I really wanted to know, can you fake it till you make it? Like, can you do this just for a little while and actually experience a behavioral outcome that makes you seem more powerful? So we know that our nonverbals govern how other people think and feel about us. There's a lot of evidence, but our question really was, do our nonverbals govern how we think and feel about ourselves? There's some evidence that they do. So, for example, when we smile when we feel happy, but also when we're forced to smile by holding a pen in our teeth like this, it makes us feel happy. So it goes both ways. When it comes to power, it also goes both ways. So when you feel powerful, you're more likely to do this, but it's also possible that when you pretend to be powerful, you are more likely to actually feel powerful. So the second question really was, you know, so we know that our minds change our bodies, but is it also true that our bodies change our minds? And when I say minds, in the case of the powerful, what am I talking about? So I'm talking about thoughts and feelings and the sort of physiological things that make up our thoughts and feelings, and in my case, that's hormones. I look at hormones. So what do the minds of the powerful versus the powerless look like? So powerful people tend to be, not surprisingly, more assertive and more confident, more optimistic. They actually feel that they're going to win even at games of chance. They also tend to be able to think more abstractly. So there are a lot of differences. They take more risks. There are a lot of differences between powerful and powerless people. Physiologically, there also are differences on two key hormones, testosterone, which is the dominance hormone, and cortisol, which is the stress hormone. So what we find is that high power alpha males in primate hierarchies have high testosterone and low cortisol. And powerful and effective leaders also have high testosterone and low cortisol. So what does that mean? When you think about power, people tended to think only about testosterone because that was about dominance. But really, power is also about how you react to stress. So do you want the high power leader that's dominant, high on testosterone, but really stress reactive? Probably not, right? You want the person who's powerful and assertive and dominant, but not very stress reactive, the person who's laid back. So we know that in primate hierarchies, if an alpha needs to take over, if an individual needs to take over an alpha role sort of suddenly, Within a few days, that individual's testosterone has gone up significantly and his cortisol has dropped significantly. So we have this evidence both that the body can shape the mind, at least at the facial level, and also that role changes can shape the mind. So what happens, okay, you take a role change, what happens if you do that at a really minimal level, like this tiny manipulation, this tiny intervention, for 2 minutes you say, I want you to stand like this, and it's gonna make you feel more powerful. So this is what we did. We decided to bring people into the lab and run a little experiment, and these people adopted for 2 minutes either high power poses or low power poses. And I'm just gonna show you five of the poses, although they took on only two. So here's one, couple more. This one has been dubbed the Wonder Woman by the media. Here are a couple more. So you can be standing or you can be sitting. And here are the low power poses. So you're folding up, you're making yourself small. This one is very low power. When you're touching your neck, you're really kind of protecting yourself. So this is what happens. They come in, they spit into a vial. We, for 2 minutes, say, you need to do this or this. They don't look at pictures of the poses. We don't want to prime them with the concept of power. We want them to be feeling power, right? So 2 minutes, they do this. We then ask them, how powerful do you feel on a series of items? And then we give them an opportunity to gamble. And then we take another saliva sample. That's it, that's the whole experiment. So this is what we find. Risk tolerance, which is the gambling, what we find is that when you're in the high power pose condition, 86% of you will gamble. When you're in the low power pose condition, only 60%, and that's a pretty whopping significant difference. Here's what we find on testosterone. From their baseline when they come in, high power people experience about a 20% increase, and low power people.
Our final speaker tonight has been a well-respected member of the Murray State community for over 10 years. His list of academic sports achievements and is extensive, but even more so is his excellence in teaching. Originally from California, Dr. David Gessler received his bachelor's from the University of California at Davis. Shortly after, he moved to Murray, Kentucky in 1996, where he received his master's in organizational communication from this very university. But he didn't stop there. As the title of doctor implies, he went to University of Tennessee at Knoxville and received his PhD. 2 years before earning his PhD, Dr. Gessler worked as a corporate trainer for a multinational firm in Nashville. It was during this period he discovered his love for teaching. And in the time he spent furthering his education, he held several different teaching positions, such as associate, adjunct, and assistant professor. Over his career, Dr. Gessler has earned numerous awards. In 2003, he was awarded the Outstanding Graduate Teaching Associate Award at University of Tennessee. He's earned the Kentucky Communication Association Award for Excellence in Teaching, the Department Representative for Board of Regents Award for Teaching Excellence, as well as Top Paper and Top 3 Paper for the Southern States Communication Association in 2003. Outside of his academic achievements, Dr. Gessler is a dedicated and loving father. To say he's an inspiration is truly an understatement. Please help me give a warm welcome to Dr. David Gessler.
We doing okay today?
Yeah.
Everybody good?
Yeah.
All right. Before we get started today on what I want to talk about, I have a confession. Hi, my name's Dave. And my confession is this. Growing up, I used to wear a Superman t-shirt. And this t-shirt, I truly believed, gave me super strength, super speed, super courage. I was super. And you might say, well, Dave, that's okay. A lot of children growing up, they pretend they're superheroes all the time. I was 18 at the time. Now, before you say, "Whoa, Dave, we got to go, take you somewhere," hear me out. I used to wear that Superman T-shirt underneath my football pads when I played football, and I truly believed, like I said, that it would give me these powers. Ask my opponents; they would say it didn't help them a darn bit. But
I felt that it did. But that leads me to what I would like to talk to you about today. And let's start with a quiz. You didn't know you were going to take a test when you came in here. But let's take a superhero quiz, right? Because that gets me thinking about superheroes. How many superheroes can you name? And if you need me to help you, I can do that, right? I can say his name's Bruce. He actually doesn't have any superpowers. He's got a lot of money. He has a lot of toys.
Batman.
I could say Peter.
Parker.
Spider-Man, all right, fine. You didn't let me go, that's okay. You're not playing along. That's all right. This man, he's big. He's a good looking guy. Has lots of powers, and he puts some glasses on. I can't recognize him. I don't know who he is. Takes the glasses off. Oh my gosh, it's
Superman.
Okay, so you get the point. It makes me think that we could probably sit here all day and think of hundreds of superheroes that we all know and love, right? And it makes me think, why are we fascinated with superheroes? Why is that? Why are we so enamored with superheroes? And if you don't believe me, if you don't think that's the case, just look at the last decade in movies. Think about any movies in the last decade have been about superheroes. Lots. And say, so don't they represent, why? Maybe we're fascinated with superheroes because don't they represent all the things that we want to be, that we strive to be, right? Think of all the things superheroes are. They're strong. They're courageous. They're brave. They do all the things, they behave and they act in the ways that we wish we could be, right? And so I think that's part of the reason why we are fascinated. But ultimately, superheroes make the world a better place, right? They make the world a better place for what they do, for how they act, for how they think, for who they are. They make the world a better place, and I love that. I love thinking about the notion that we are here to make this world better, right? We have that thought a lot of times, don't we? Why are we here? That's an existential, huge question. Why are we here? And I truly believe, I think one of the reasons is to make this place better. And it reminds me of this quote, one of my favorite quotes by the late great creator of the Muppets, Jim Henson, who says, "My hope is to leave this world a little better for having been here." And I actually have that quote in my pocket, in my wallet. I've had it there for about the last 25 years. And I try every day to live my life that way. And I love that. My hope is to leave this world a little bit better. My daughter, who's here today, she knows this very well, in that a lot of times she'll come home and maybe there's been some drama at school, or maybe she's had some issues going on somewhere in her life. And I'll ask her one simple question. Did you make it better or did you make it worse? And if you made it better, fantastic. Let's keep doing that behavior. Let's keep doing that. If you made it worse, let's change that. Right? It's a really simple question. So superheroes, as we know them, ultimately, they don't exist. Unfortunately. We all wish they probably would. We all want these people to come in and make the world a better place. But they don't exist. Or do they? Well, maybe. I contend that we can be superheroes. I contend that each one of us here today has to be a superhero. And I think we can be hope ninjas. That's what I've called it. We can all be hope ninjas. We have to be hope ninjas. Right? That's what we have to become. That's what we have to do. We got to make this world a better place. And maybe through being hope ninjas, we can make this world a better place. Okay? And as it says up there, I know what you're saying, because I said the same thing, right? Oh my gosh, Dave, are you serious? There's no way I can be a superhero. I can't even get up in the morning, right? I got to have my coffee, my energy drink. I gotta have something to get me going. So how can I be a superhero? Good question, right? Real good question. Let's think about it. How does Superman get up in the morning?
I don't know, he just fought crime the night before, right? Put some bad guys in jail. He's tired. You know, had a microwave dinner. Goes home, goes to bed. You know he's got to get up early in the morning for the paper. That's an early gig. So, how does Superman get up out of bed in the morning? A little coffee, a little toast, right? No butter, got to stay fit. A little bacon. No. I think it's the hope of a better world. I think how Superman gets up every morning is the notion that he can make the world a better place, that he has a hope of making this world a better place. That's what gets him up every morning. That's what gets him up and going in this world. Hope. So I've kind of introduced this notion, this term of hope ninja to you, right? So why hope? And hope is one of 10 forms of positivity as coined by a positivity researcher, Dr. Barbara Fredrickson. And hope, as you see it up there, is the belief that things can change for the better, right? That's so important. That's so important to have that hope, that we can believe that things will change for the better, okay? And not only that, but it's becoming energized to make the world a good place for ourselves and for others. Again, how cool is that? Think about the lack of hope. What is that, the lack of hope? Hopelessness, despair, fear, those are terrible places to be. Those are awful places for people, human beings, to be. And if we can help people not be in those places, I think we need to do that. I think we have to do that, right? This notion of positivity, and again, I focused on hope here, but this whole notion of positivity, it builds people. It broadens people. It makes people more creative, right? Positivity has nothing to do with the fact that we are not going to have bad times in our lives, because we will. This is life. Bad things are going to happen to us. That's it. But how do we react to those things? How do we react to the bad things that happen to us? Right? If we become positive, hopeful in this case, but in general positive, we're going to bounce back quicker, because life is not always puppy dog tails and balloons. It's just not going to be. Okay? Ninja! Why ninja? And when I first thought of this, right, I was talking to a class, and I said, you know what? I want to be somebody that spreads hope to others. I want to be like a superhero of hope, as I was just kind of, you know, working through this with my class. And the first thing I said was, I want to be a hope Hulk. And I'm going to wham people with hope. And then I thought, that's not a very hopeful way to get the thing started with them unconscious as I wham them. So the hope Hulk, it didn't go very far, that idea. But then I thought, what about ninja? What about ninja as a superhero, right? Think about ninja. When you think about ninjas, what do you think about? Don't you think about all those things that are up there? Strength. They're scaling buildings. They're traversing, you know, difficult terrain. Skill. Preciseness. They know what they're doing, and they're good at it. Right? Success. They ultimately always accomplish their mission. Ninjas accomplish their mission. They had a different way of thinking. They were unlike the other warriors at the time, right? The samurai had a very rule-oriented way of fighting and doing things. And the ninjas said, you know what? We're not doing stuff that way. Like, if we have to get X accomplished, we're going to do A, B, and C to get to X. We're not going to necessarily go this way. If we have to go this way, we'll do that. So they didn't follow those rules. They thought a different way. And they had a hope for a better world. They had a hope for a better future. And probably one of the coolest things about ninjas that you may or may not have known But ninjas were common people. They were you, they were me, they were everybody. They were farmers, they were villagers, even women. And in that day and age, women were basically nothing, but yet they could be ninjas. That's awesome, right? Everybody could be a ninja. Fantastic. So how can we be Hope Ninjas? How can we do this, right? How can we make the world a better place by being Hope Ninjas? We have to be committed to having hope within ourselves and passing that hope along to others, right? And that's, again, that's what we have to do. Because here's the deal, folks. Organizations aren't instilling hope in people. Murray State University is a great place, but Murray State University is only the place because of the people. And so Murray State doesn't instill hope in anybody. It's the people at Murray State that instill hope in people. That's what makes this a great place. Now, I don't care what organization you belong to, your family, that's a great family. No, it's the people in that family that's why that's a great family. Your church is awesome. Yes, it is, but it's not the church. It's the people in the church. So guess what? It comes down to you and it comes down to me. We have to do this. But ultimately, who do I have control over? Who do you have control over? Ourselves. That's it. Right? I can do my best to pass along hope to you or to other people, but I can't make you have hope. Maybe if I was a Hope Hulk, I guess I could, but no. Right? So I've got to do my best to have hope within me. Because that's what I ultimately have control over, is me. Right? So how do we do this? Super important. We have to do this. We have to have hope. We have to pass that on to others, but how? Ultimately, we got to choose to be positive, folks. Being positive is a choice. And I know there are people out there saying right now, Gessler, God, you know what? You're just born that way. True. I was. Hear me out. I was born a positive, optimistic guy. I just always have been. But yet I've gotten better at it over the years. Some of you might now be saying, yeah, a little over the top, but that's okay. But yes, I've gotten better at it over the years. And here's the thing. Even if you weren't born a positive person, you can get better at it. It's a skill. It's a choice. We have to choose to be positive. We got to choose it. How do we do that? You got to think what is good, what is right, what is beautiful in this world. Take the time and just saying those things to yourself, just focusing on what is good, what is right, what is beautiful, will put you in a more positive mood. Why are you thankful? What are you thankful for right now? Take a second and think about why are you thankful right now? There's always something to be thankful for. And maybe it's just this. I'm still breathing. Maybe that's all you got today. But you can still focus on it and you can still be thankful for it. And that's still a positive change. Right? Smile! Right? Smile at people. When people engage you, when they interact with you, smile. Now again, don't be creepy. Don't do that. Be genuine. Be available to people. Right? This isn't easy. I know it's an effort. But be available to people. Put your phone down. Interact with people. Look people in the eye. Right? Those teeny tiny inconsequential interactions every day do have meaning. When the person checking out your groceries at the store says, hey, how are you? Engage. Hey, how are you? What's going on? You don't have to tell them your life story. But be genuine about it. Engage them. Be a human being, right? Listen to people. A lot of times people just want somebody to listen to them. Just be a support for others. Listen. Be genuine. Really take in what they're saying, right? And love. We gotta love. We gotta love, folks. That's what this world's about. And the people that say love is a weak emotion, I totally disagree, because guess what? I can hate anybody for any reason, that's easy. But you love the people who did you wrong, that's hard. You love the people that disagree with you, that's difficult. You love the people that don't think like you do, that don't dress like you do, that don't look like you do, that's hard. Loving people is difficult.
That's the stronger emotion. We gotta love. So overall, let's be superheroes. Let's be hope ninjas. And just so you all don't worry about me too much, I no longer pretend to be a superhero. I no longer wear the Superman shirt under my clothes anymore, so you don't have to worry. So I don't pretend to be a superhero anymore. But you know what? I know I'm a superhero now. Thank you. Get it. I hope you enjoyed the show. Phil Van Hoosier will be outside signing his book.
After pushing the limits of pushing buttons.
To talk with him or any of our speakers, please stick around and do so. Thank you very much.